Last time we talked about different three-dimensional curvilinear coordinate systems, and today we're going to talk about differential operators and how they look in those different coordinate systems. First, before we start that, let me remind you what the displacement vector looks like in the different systems. So in Cartesian coordinates, the displacement vector is just x times the unit vector in the x direction, and then the same for the other two directions, y times ey plus z times ez. Sometimes this, in the intro courses, this is written as xi hat plus yj hat plus zk hat. In spherical polar three-dimensional coordinates, there is only one component. There is only the radial component r multiplied by a unit vector in the r direction, and nothing else. There is no e theta hat times some function of theta. There is no e phi hat times any function of phi. Just one component. And in three-dimensional cylindrical polar coordinates, there are two components to R. There is the radial piece. S, remember, is the distance from the z-axis out to the point, in the, whatever point in the space you're looking at. So it's S times ES hat plus z times EZ hat, and there's no E phi hat. So two components in cylindrical polar coordinates. Okay, now we can start talking about differential operators, and the differential operators will have to act on something, and that thing will be a function of the coordinates. So let's start with the simplest version. Consider a scalar field, and don't be scared by the terminology here. Field just means function of coordinates, functions of, in general, functions of q1, q2, and q3. If you were in Cartesian coordinates, it would just be a function of x, y, and z. And if you want to include time dependence, everything I'm going to discuss today are static fields, but if you wanted to include the time, that's okay too. It's still called a field. So a function of x, y, z, and t for time would still be a field. It would be a time-dependent field. There are going to be different fields, two of them today, a scalar field and a vector field. So let's start with the scalar field. It's a little bit simpler. And I'd like you to think of the scalar field as a machine. So the scalar field is represented by this box here. And the machine has three inputs where you will tell it what the coordinates are. So you will input q1, q2, and q3. And the output will be a single number. The prototypical example of a scalar field is the temperature field in the room. So if I want to describe the temperature at any given point in a room, once you tell me the three coordinates, so these could be x, y, and z, or you could tell me r, theta, and phi, the radius, the latitude, and the longitude, but you need three of them if you're in three dimensions. Whatever coordinate system you're using, you'll have three inputs to locate the point in the room, and then once you specify that point, I will come back and tell you one single number, and that will be the temperature at that point in the room. So that's an example of a scalar field, a scalar function of coordinates. All right, there are different notations. The first one, if I write t as a function, and then in parentheses, r vector, without picking a coordinate system, this is called coordinate-free notation. This is useful because oftentimes you don't want to pick a coordinate system. You want to let your reader or your listener do that later, and then it's up to them which coordinate system they want to use. If you pick generalized coordinates, then the temperature will be a function of q1, q2, and q3. If you want to specify the Cartesian system, then the temperature is a function of x, y, and z, and so on for the other systems. An example of using a Cartesian system would be maybe if you're looking at a city block that was laid out on a grid, you could tell your reader to go 1 meter east or 1 mile east, 2 miles north, and 3 miles up to give the altitude. Okay, any system of units that you like. But it does require three coordinates along three mutually perpendicular directions. In the spherical system, an example might be, well, I'll use the center of the Earth as my origin for coordinates, and I'll tell you the radius is 4,000 miles, so we'll be on the surface of the Earth, not inside the Earth and not hovering above it. And I'll tell you the latitude, theta, and I'll tell you the longitude, phi, and that's enough to locate some point on the surface of the Earth, and then this function T of those coordinates would tell you the temperature at that particular location on the planet. Here are some made-up examples just so you can get used to the notation. A temperature field, a temperature function of x, y, and z might be this. It might be x squared times the square root of y plus the cosine of z. The important thing to notice in this example is that there are no vectors on the right-hand side. There's no ex hat, ey hat, or ez hat. That makes it a scalar. Okay, it has magnitude only and no direction, so it's a scalar, but it's a function of coordinates, so it's a scalar field. And here's an example from a different system. In spherical coordinates, I will give you the temperature as a function of r, theta, and phi. And an example might be 1 over r times the secant of phi. And you could have as many terms on the right-hand side as you want. This first example had two terms on the right. The second only had one. Any number of terms is allowed on the right-hand side, but no vectors. So in the second example, no er hat, no e theta hat, no e phi hat. That makes it a scalar function. Okay, the other kind of field we need to consider is a vector field. And again, I'd like you to think of the field as a machine. So that's represented by the box. Again, it has three inputs. So you will tell me the coordinates. You will tell me the Q1, Q2, and Q3, and whatever coordinate system you like. And now I'll tell you three numbers. So going back up to the scalar field machine, the output was a single number, like the temperature at a given point in the room. But now I will tell you three numbers. I will tell you the 1, 2, and 3 components of some three-dimensional vector. So this one subscript is measured along the Q1 direction, and the same for the others. This V2 is measured along the Q2 direction, and the same for 3. An example of this would be the electrical field in the room. So you tell me three numbers to locate the position in the room. You tell me the Q1, Q2, and Q3. And I will tell you not just one number, but I'll tell you three numbers. I'll tell you the 1 component of the electrical field, and then separately the 2 component of the electrical field and the 3 component of the electrical field. I can't just tell you one number because the electrical field is a vector. It has magnitude and direction. The temperature field above only had magnitude and no direction, but the electrical field in my second example has 3 vector components, and they will be different if you pick Cartesian coordinates. This is electrical field in the x direction, electrical field in the y direction, and z direction. But you could have picked spherical polar coordinates, and so this would be the electrical field in the r direction, the electrical field in the theta direction, the electrical field in the phi direction. But whatever coordinate system you pick, there will be in general 3 coordinates. For example, this is the polar coordinate of some vector. So if these were Cartesian coordinates, I could talk about v sub x, v sub y, and v sub z. But in the spherical system, I can talk about the radial component. So if the subscript were r here, v sub r would be the radial component. V sub theta happens to be the polar component of the vector field, and v sub phi is the azimuthal component of the vector. And how do you get that? You take the three-dimensional vector and take the dot product with one of the unit vectors. In this case, take the dot product with e theta hat unit vector, and that will give you the polar component of v. So that's the left-hand side is a number. On the right-hand side, v is a vector, three-dimensional vector, and e theta hat is a unit vector. The dot product of 2 vectors is a scalar. So this thing on the right-hand side is just a number, but it's the theta component of the vector field. Here is the velocity vector field, not velocity, it could be velocity. Velocity is an example of a vector field, but here is the vector field written first on the left-hand side in coordinate-free notation. So this is v vector, which is a function of r vector, and I haven't picked a coordinate system. On the right-hand side, I've picked generalized coordinates q1, q2, and q3, and it looks like this. There is a 1 component to the vector field. That 1 component can depend on all 3 coordinates, Q1, Q2, and Q3. That gets multiplied by a unit vector in the 1 direction. Remember, E1 points in the direction of increasing Q1. But in general, if you're not using Cartesian coordinates, then the unit vectors themselves are functions of the coordinates. So E1 can depend on Q1, Q2, and Q3. And the same for the other directions. So here's the two component of the vector field. It depends on all three coordinates. That gets multiplied by a unit vector in the two direction, in the direction of increase in Q2. But that unit vector depends where you are in the space, and that can depend on Q1, Q2, and Q3 as well. And the same for the third component. Cartesian coordinates are maybe the simplest of all. So if you take the coordinate-free representation of the vector, the vector as a function of R vector, then the first component is Vx. So this is the component of the vector along the x direction. That could be a function. That could be a function of the three coordinates x, y, and z. But it gets multiplied by the unit vector Ex, and now I don't need any parenthetical functional dependence here because Ex is a constant. Ex does not depend on where you are in the space. It always points in the same direction. So that's unique to Cartesian coordinates. And the same for the other two components. Vy can be a function of x, y, and z, and it gets multiplied by Ey hat, but Ey hat, again, is a constant. It doesn't depend on where you are in the space. And similarly for the z direction. Here is another made-up example, just so you could get used to the notation. The vector function of coordinates, the vector field, might be this. It might be x cubed y to the fourth, and so you can see that's vx. And in this example, vx happens to depend on x and y, but not z, and that's by my choice. I could have included z dependence in there, I just chose not to. The Vy component is the thing that multiplies Ey hat, and that happens to be 1 over x times the sine of y. Again, I didn't choose to put any z dependence in there, although I could have. And the Vz component is just 3. That doesn't have any x or y or z dependence. It's just a number. It's just a constant 3. Again, it could have been anything. I could have, this last component, this Vz that I put in the box, could have been 3 plus x plus y squared plus the sine of z divided by the square root of y. Could be arbitrarily complicated, but in general, it's some function that depends on the three coordinates. Okay, in spherical polar coordinates, the thing that multiplies er hat is called the radial component of the field, or v sub r, and v sub r is a function. It could depend on r, theta, and phi in general. And now the unit vector, ER, also depends on coordinates. Well, it happens not to depend on R, but it does depend on theta and phi, the other two spherical coordinates. And that's because ER changes its direction. As you move around in space, ER is not a constant vector like EX, EY, and EZ. ER points in different directions depending on where you are. So you have to tell me. You have to tell me your latitude, theta, and your longitude, phi, and then I'll tell you in which direction ER points. The thing that multiplies E theta hat is called the polar component of the vector field, and the thing that multiplies E phi hat is called the azimuthal component of the vector field. Again, in general, they're functions of all three coordinates. Here again is a completely made-up example. The radial component of this vector field, the thing that multiplies ER hat, I just chose to be 1 over R tangent theta, so it happens to depend on R and theta, but not phi. It could have depended on phi. I could have multiplied this by cosine phi, for example. The polar component of the field, I just chose arbitrarily to be theta squared, so this happens to depend on theta and not r and not phi, but it could have depended on the other two coordinates. And the azimuthal component of the field, of I chose to depend on everything, so it's r tangent of phi times the cosine squared of theta. Again, any arbitrary function of r, theta, and phi is allowed. All right, now I'm going to tell you something important. Just because you arrange three numbers in a column, or maybe you multiply these by unit vectors, so for example, you might take two apples and multiply that by ex hat, take one banana, multiply that by ey hat, take three peaches, multiply that by ez hat, that does not make it a vector. A vector in physics has a very special meaning, and a vector changes under rotations of the coordinate system. Anything that transforms like the position vector, r hat, is called a vector. So some examples of things that are vectors are the velocity vector, the acceleration vector, the momentum vector, the angular momentum vector, the force vector, the torque vector. Okay, they all transform under coordinate rotations like the position vector r, and so they are all vectors. This example up in red is not a vector, because if you rotate your coordinate systems, you still have two apples, you still have one banana, you still have three peaches. So in fact, this example in the box, these are a collection of three scalars, and taking three scalars and arranging them in a column does not make them into a vector. Okay, so it all has to do with how these things change under coordinate rotations. Hopefully now you understand a little bit better what a scalar field means and what a vector field means. And now we can start operating on them. So let's talk about differential operators. There are going to be three first order differential operators, the gradient, the divergence, and the curl, and we'll take them in order. In this lecture, we'll only talk about the first one, the gradient. And then later on, we can combine two first order differential operators to get second order differential operators, third order differential operators, fourth order, and so on. There's no end to the infinite tower of operators. Typically in physics, the first order and the second order are used most frequently, so those are the ones we'll talk about. Again, I think it's helpful to think of these operators as machines, as boxes, and so what does the gradient machine do? Well, you're going to feed it a scalar function of position. So for example, the temperature field in the room, that's the input. You'll put that into the gradient box, and the gradient machine will produce for you a vector field. It will produce, so the input is a scalar field, the output is a vector field. And remember, the vector field is not just one field out, it's three fields. It's V1, which depends on Q1, Q2, and Q3. It's V2, which depends on Q1, Q2, and Q3, and then V3, which also depends on the three coordinates. Instead of writing Q1, Q2, Q3, I chose to use the coordinate tree representation. I just called it R-hat. So you can pick any coordinate system that you like. But the important thing is a scalar field goes in, not a number, not just a single component, but a whole field, a whole function defined everywhere in the space. So the input is a scalar function, the output is a vector function. So for example, you might put in, let me pick a different scalar field other than temperature for a second. How about the voltage? The voltage field in the room is also a scalar function. So you tell me what the voltage is at any point in the room, and the gradient machine will output the electrical field in the room, actually the negative of the electrical field in the room, but something related to the electrical field, which is a vector field. There is a symbol that is used to represent the gradient, and you'll also see this used when we talk about the divergence later and the curl, and that is this inverted delta with a vector sign over it. This symbol is called a nabla. That comes from the Greek word for harp, because it kind of looks like a harp if you took a little artistic license. It's also called del. So people talk about del of t, or if in the case of the divergence, del dot t, in the case of the curl, del cross t. And if you're writing it like I am in the notes, then I have to put a vector sign over it to let you know that's a vector operator. If you saw this typeset in a book, they might use a boldface for the triangle, and then they would omit the vector sign over the top. But the boldface would tell you that it's a vector. There's another common notation. So if you look in some books, particularly older books, you'll see this notation. Instead of using the nabla symbol, you'll see the word grad, short for gradient, written out in front. And again, if it's handwritten, there'll be a vector sign over the top. And if it's in print, then the letters GRAD would be represented in boldface, indicating that that's a vector operator. What does this mean physically? Well, let me give you this example. Hopefully you've encountered a topographic map somewhere before. And so imagine that you have a hole over here on the left, and then a hill over here on the right, and these lines represent lines of constant height, constant altitude. So let's say the bottom of the hole is 40 feet down, And then there are some points that are 30 feet below sea level, and then 20 feet below sea level, 10 feet below sea level, and then at sea level, and then 10 feet above, 20 feet above, and then the top of the hill might be 30 feet above. If you were to look down on this and make a topographic map, you would see these circles. For example, this one, the minus 20 circle, would be represented that way. And so all these contours are contours of constant height. So the dot in the middle is the negative 40 foot depth of the hole. And then there's a circle at negative 30 feet, and then another circle at negative 20, and another circle at negative 10 feet. And then for the hill, there's a dot representing the top of the hill at plus 30. There's a ring of points at plus 20 feet, and then a ring of points at 10 feet above sea level. So what does the gradient operator do? The gradient operator points in the direction of steepest increase. So if you're right at the bottom of the hole and you take a step in any direction, well, any direction will increase your height. Any direction will take you from minus 40 to some higher elevation. And so right at that point, the gradient is zero. It's not defined because the arrow could point in any direction. But if you're here, if you're halfway up the hill, the gradient points in the direction of steepest increase. So it points toward the top of the hill and directly toward the top of the hill. So that it's easier to see this red arrow drawn over here. That's this one. It's pointing directly to the top of the hill. Okay, so you can imagine if you're standing on a surface, you take a step in any direction and you see which unit step in any direction gives you the largest increase in your elevation, and that's the direction of the gradients. That's what it does. Let me show you the gradient operator in different coordinate systems. Again, Cartesian is easiest, so we'll start with that. So let's take the gradient of our scalar function of position. Let's take the gradient of T of R. Well, this operation in Cartesian coordinates looks like this. First, I take the partial derivative of T. Remember, T is a function of coordinates. T depends on X and Y and Z. I take the partial derivative of T with respect to X. And I hope you're familiar with partial derivatives. If not, here's a quick review. So when you do this operation, you only vary X and you treat Y and Z like constants in that first term. After you take this derivative, that derivative operation produces V of X. It produces the component of the vector field along the X direction. You would then multiply that by EX hat. And then repeat for the other directions to figure out the Y component of the gradient of T, which is a vector. You take the partial derivative of T with respect to Y. So you only vary Y. You treat X and Z as constants. When you're done taking the derivative, you multiply that result by EY hat, and then do the same in the Z direction. And when you're all done, add up those three components together. Again, here's an example to make things clear, a fictitious example, just completely made up. So imagine that the scalar function, I changed the notation, I called it F instead of T, but it's still a scalar. Imagine that the scalar function of position is X squared times the sine of Y plus cosine Z. Notice that there are no vectors on the right-hand side of F. That indicates it's a scalar field, a scalar function of position. And now I want to take the gradient of F. The gradient of F will be a vector. Remember, the gradient machine takes in a scalar function, produces a vector function. So the gradient of F will be a vector. And the first thing I should do is this. Take the partial derivative of F with respect to X, hold Y and Z constant. So I look through here, I look through F, and I see where the X dependence is. It's only in the first term. When I take the partial derivative of X squared sine Y, I treat the sine Y as if it were a constant, and the partial derivative with respect to X will give me 2X. So just acting on X squared, the partial derivative is 2X, and the sine comes along because it's a constant. What about the cosine Z? Well, there is no X dependence in cosine Z. So when I take the partial derivative with respect to X of cosine Z, I treat like a constant, the derivative of a constant is zero. So the answer is I only get 2x sine y for the first component, and then I have to multiply that by ex hat. right, let's try it again for the y component. I should take the partial derivative of my function f with respect to y. So again, look through here and see where the y dependence is. It's only in the sign. When I take the partial derivative, I treat the x squared like a constant. So that comes along for the ride. The derivative of sine of y is cosine of y. And cosine of z doesn't have any y dependence. And so when I take the derivative with respect to y, I just get zero. So the y component is simply x squared times the cosine of y. And then I multiply that by e y hat. And then lastly, I need to do this. I need to take the partial derivative with respect to z of my function f. Well, the first term doesn't have any z dependence in it, so I treat x and y like constants. When you take the partial of the boxed term with respect to z, you just get zero. And then when I look at the second term, the partial derivative with respect to z of cosine z is negative sine z, so that's where the negative sign came from, negative sine, and then I multiply that by ez hat, and then I add those three components together. So in the box, this is represented in unit vector notation. You could also represent it as a column vector or as a row vector. But in any way you represent it, it is a vector. So the gradient of a scalar field is a vector field. It has three components, and there are vectors that appear on the right-hand side. They're either explicitly written here, like ex hat, ey hat, ez hat, or they are implied when you use this column or row notation. The fact that you're not adding these, you're just representing them as a list, tells you you should multiply the first one by EX, you should multiply the second one by EY, multiply the third one by EZ. All right, so that was the Cartesian case. If you're using generalized coordinates, Q1, Q2, and Q3, then the scalar field will be a function of Q1, Q2, and Q3. The gradient in generalized coordinates looks like this. Remember, the gradient of a scalar is a vector, so I should expect vectors on the right-hand side, and sure enough, there's an E1 hat, an E2 hat, E3 hat, and now you see those scale factors or scale functions appearing again in the denominator, so there's H1, H2, and H3, and now each unit vector is divided by its appropriate scale factor, so E1 hat, for example, is divided by H1, and then that gets multiplied by the partial derivative of the scalar function t with respect to coordinate q1. So again, when you do this, you vary q1, but you hold q2 and q3 fixed, you treat them like constants. And then repeat for the second component, repeat for the third component. When you're done, add them together. For the special case of spherical polar coordinates, the gradient operation looks like this. The three unit vectors, e1 hat, e2 hat, e3 hat, are er hat, e theta hat, and e phi hat. And in the denominators, you can see the scale factors. The scale factor that goes along with r is hr, which is 1, so that's invisible. And then h theta, we figured out last time, was r. And h phi, scale factor, was r sine theta. And in the first term, I take the derivative of the scalar function t with respect to r. I hold the theta and the phi fixed. Next, I take the partial derivative of the scalar function t with respect to theta, hold the r and the phi fixed, and then lastly, take the derivative, partial derivative of t with respect to azimuthal angle phi, and hold the r and the theta fixed. In cylindrical polar coordinates, you would do this. The coordinates are s, phi, and z, and so there's an es hat, there's an e phi hat, there's an ez hat, and in the denominators, you can see the scale factors. This is on your latest homework assignment. Hs is 1, so that's invisible. H phi is s, and hz is 1 again, so that's invisible. Okay, now that may have been a little esoteric, so let's go through a real life example, and I'll do it in two different coordinate systems so you can see the advantage of switching to a different coordinate system. Like I told you, one of the previous lectures, you can use any coordinate system to solve any problem, but if you choose the wrong tool for the job, then it gets really tedious and complicated. So if you were doing a problem with spherical symmetry, then you'd want to use spherical polar coordinates, and I'll show you how that makes your life easy. All right, let's go back to physics 1304, electrostatics. And suppose I tell you the voltage. This is what you may have called V in your 1304 course, let me not call it V because I'm using V for vector field and it would just get too confusing if I do that. Another common notation for the voltage or the electrical potential is capital Greek letter phi, so let me call it that. Capital phi of R on the left-hand side is written in coordinate free notation. Remember, I just use R vector. I don't tell you what coordinate system to use. But if I pick Cartesian coordinates, X, Y, and Z, then in MKS units, the voltage looks like this for a point charge. Let's consider a point charge at the origin. There's a factor of 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught in MKS units. There is the charge Q. And then the denominator is the distance away from the origin. And so in three-dimensional Cartesian coordinates, that's the square root of the quantity x squared plus y squared plus z squared. All right, now take that same voltage function, take that same phi of r, but instead of writing it in Cartesian xyz coordinates, write it in terms of spherical coordinates, r, theta, and phi, and you see the great simplification. There's still that MKS constant 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught out in front. There's still a charge in the numerator. But this combination of Cartesian coordinates is just exactly what you mean by the radial spherical coordinate. And so this depends only on R, and there is no theta dependence and there is no phi dependence. That's a result of the symmetry. Over here in the Cartesian version, the X's and the Y's and the Z's were all treated on equal footing. That tells you you really can't tell the difference between the three directions. They're all equivalent. And choosing spherical polar coordinates makes that manifest. The distance is represented by R only and not theta and not phi. So you can see already the voltage is a whole lot simpler. But watch and see what happens when we take the gradient of the voltage to get the electrical field. And you'll see how much simpler it is to work in spherical polar coordinates than it is to work in Cartesian coordinates. Okay, so remembering back to your electrostatics course, the electrical field is the negative gradient of the voltage. And in Cartesian coordinates, it will look like this. The electrical field will be a vector field, a vector function of coordinates. So E vector will depend on X and Y and Z. And I need to do the following operation. There's a negative sign in the definition, so I just carried that down here. This thing in square brackets is the nabla, or the del, that's the gradient operator. That gradient operator will act on the voltage function phi. See, in the gradient operator, there are partial derivatives. These have to act on something. D by dx has to act on something. D by dy has to act on something. D by dz has to act on something. So this operator only makes sense if there's something written to the right of it. And all those partial derivatives will act on the voltage function. All right, this is so complicated and so tedious to write out that I'm only going to do the first one. I'm only going to take the partial derivative with respect to x of the voltage function phi, and then I'll multiply that by negative ex hat. Okay, so let's start by doing that. What is the partial derivative with respect to x of the voltage function phi? Well, I look up above. And I copy this voltage function down here, cut and paste. I need to take the partial derivative with respect to x of that. The constants can come out in front. So the charge is a constant. The 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught is a constant. That comes out in front of the derivative. And then I have to take the partial with respect to x of this, 1 over the square root of x squared plus y squared plus z squared. For convenience, I'm going to write that this way. X squared plus y squared plus z squared, all raised to the negative 1/2 power. That represents the square root in the denominator. Again, it's just a little bit easier to take the derivatives in the second notation. So you're supposed to bring the exponent down in front. This exponent is minus 1/2, and so there it is in front. And then take the parenthetical expression and decrement the exponent by 1. So negative 1/2 minus 1 is negative 3/2. And then you're not done. You need to use the chain rule. We need to look inside the parentheses and take the derivative of everything in that blue box with respect to x, holding y and z fixed. Well, if you hold y and z fixed, these are constants. When you take the derivative with respect to x, you'll get 0. But when you take the derivative with respect to x of x squared, you get 2x. And now some algebra, the 2 cancels the 1/2, and so I can write this as negative q over 4 pi epsilon naught x in the numerator divided by the square root of x squared plus y squared plus c squared, all raised to the third power in the denominator. Well, once you've seen this calculation for the x component, you can guess what the y components are and the z components are going to look like. The x component has an x in the numerator, so that's right here. What happened to the negative sign? The negative sign got canceled by this negative sign in the definition of the electrical field. So I took this result and I multiplied the box by negative ex hat. So the negative sign went away and the ex hat is written right there. But the x component had an x in the numerator. The y component will have a y in the numerator. The z component will have a z in the numerator. Again, because in Cartesian coordinates, they're all equivalent. The x direction looks just like y, looks just like z. You can't tell them apart. And now I recognize ex hat out in front times x plus ey hat times ey plus ez hat times z, that's just r. So the numerator is r vector, and the denominator is the same in each case. The denominator is the square root of x squared plus y squared plus z squared cubed. That funny squiggle is a 3. They're all 3. That's a 3, that's a 3, that's a 3. And if I write this in coordinate free notation, the denominator is the magnitude of the position vector and then cubed. So the magnitude of r right there in the box, the magnitude of r is just this Pythagorean square root. So both of them get cubed. Okay, well, that was a long, tedious calculation in Cartesian coordinates. Let me show you how much easier it is in spherical coordinates. I'm going to do it in two lines. The potential we wrote above, the potential was this. In spherical polar coordinates, it's 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught, the charge divided by the radial coordinate r. And now I have to take the negative gradient of that function of r theta and phi. But this voltage function, capital phi, only depends on r. It doesn't depend on theta and phi. And so there's only one derivative to take. I only have to take the r derivative of the voltage function. And when I'm done, I multiply that by a negative unit vector in the r direction. Well, this thing is what I have to take the derivative of, right? In square brackets, I have to take the derivative of q over epsilon naught times 1 over r. But this only depends on r and not theta and not phi. And so I don't need a partial derivative with respect to r. I can just take the regular ordinary derivative with respect to r. And this is maybe the third or fourth lecture in Calculus 1. The derivative with respect to r of 1 over r is negative 1 over r squared. And so the negative sign will cancel this negative sign out in front. And I get negative 1 over r squared. That annoying shadow box keeps appearing, so let me move the cursor out of the way. But we're done. That's it. And so the answer is, in spherical polar coordinates, the electrical field only has a radial component. It doesn't have a theta component, and it doesn't have a phi component. So it's something multiplied by er hat. And that something is q over 4 pi epsilon naught, and then 1 over r squared. And if you realize that er hat is r vector divided by r magnitude, then they both have the same coordinate-free form. They both the Cartesian calculation and the spherical calculation give you this answer in the box. But in spherical polar coordinates, the point is I got it in two lines instead of a page and a half of calculations. Okay, so that's it for the gradient operator. Next time we'll talk about the divergence operator and the curl operator in the different coordinate systems.